If you are sitting at home next to your radio, you're hearing the music faster than you are if you're in the hall.
Listening for the secret. Searching for the sound. This is The Sound Podcast with Ira Haberman. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Instagram and Twitter. Now, here's Ira.
We've been touting Nugs.net for a while, but for those of you who don't know, Nugs.net is the destination for live music on demand. They have a growing collection of over 15,000 full-length concert recordings from bands like Umphrey's McGee, Green Sky Bluegrass, and Spafford, so you'll never run out of live music to explore. You can listen to a show from last night or from 40 years ago. You can hear our favorite picks every Wednesday on Live 5, powered by Nugs.net on this very podcast. It's available on desktop, iOS, and Android apps, Sonos, and BlueOS. Just like us, the folks at Nugs.net are live music fans, so they're offering new subscribers a 35% discount on an annual subscription. Go to nugs.net/thesound and sign up today. If you already have a subscription, give the gift of live music to a friend. There's nothing better. Again, nugs.net/thesound for 35% off an annual subscription. The show starts now.
Bye.
been listening to Mr. Man by Government Mule from their forthcoming release, Bring On The Music Live at the Capitol Theater Package. The package will be available in various CD and DVD configurations, and you can check out all the configurations at mule.net. Aside from frontman and guitar wizard Warren Haynes, Government Mule is made up of three other extremely talented musicians, including founding member and drummer Matt Apps, Jorgen Carlson on bass, and keyboard and frankly multi-instrumentalist Danny Lewis. Together, this quartet makes genre and mind-bending music rooted in blues, hard rock, and Americana. Our affinity for this band has been well documented, and we've been on the Mule train since day one. So with the release of Bring On The Music forthcoming, we thought it would be fun to talk to Danny Lewis about not just this awesome musical package, but also life in Government Mule more generally, and indeed the intangible ingredients he brings to the table. Our conversation started when I asked Danny if, in his opinion, now 17 years with the band, if indeed they were firing on all cylinders like a well-oiled machine.
You know, that's a great question, Ira. We're at a really nice point right now. There's no question about it. I think in my own life, which I can really is the only thing I can speak of authoritatively, I'm at a pretty good place as a musician and as an explorer of music and how much I've discovered and how much is yet to discover. It's all a really fun place to be. I would venture to guess that the other fellows are in similar places individually, although I wouldn't speak for them on that. And the band itself as a collective is certainly got enough behind it to draw from and still enough ahead of it to be encouraged and excited and enthusiastic about things. So, by the virtual accumulation of time together, sure, we're in a really great place. But I would say that in every various incarnation of my own personal involvement, and even before that, the band was always in that enthusiastic place of discovery and expansion. And it's not been meteoric, you know, it's not like some bright meteor in the sky instantly shining its giant bright light on the music world while the band has enjoyed notoriety. I think it's been a kind of a gradual progression, and particularly during my time with the band. And so it's really gratifying to see where we're at now and all the new markets that we've opened up to play in, and all the new folks that we see coming to our shows, and the relationships that we've also fostered with longtime fans that have encouraged us to step outside of our box and try new things. That is the most amazing gift for a band to have, is an audience who says, go for it. And but I would say that our audience is notorious for pushing us forward. It's great. It's really a wonderfully healthy thing for a musician like me to be involved with.
You know, when you officially joined the band, this band was going through a heartache and substantial change in that one of the three-headed monsters in this band was no longer with the band, and I can imagine that that must have been a daunting task at the time to join Matt and Warren, given the history up until that point. Is that something that were acutely aware of at the time, and is that something that, not to disrespect, you know, Alan's passing, but is that something that's sort of to a certain degree in the rear view at this point?
I grew up as a bass player in rock bands as a kid and played in power trios. And the power trio dynamic, where each individual's character is that much more magnified and has that much more room to show itself, reveal itself. In the case of Government Mule, I would venture to say that there was no replacing Alan Woody, period. And his contribution to the band was so elemental to the band's sound that it would simply be an exercise in frustration to try to replace that. So what happened during the interim between Alan's passing and my own joining the band was that a lot of very, very close friends of the band jumped on board to help keep it going. One of those was Dave Schools from Widespread Panic, who really was one of the first guys to say, hey, Matt, hey, Warren, if you guys want to honor some obligations and continue this thing forward, I will help you while I am available. Another fellow who was part of that was Chuck Lavelle. And so there was a new school of Government Mule out there post Alan's passing that was delivering that version of Government Mule. And then Rob Baracco, the keyboard player from Phil and Friends and various Dead incarnations, was part of the family as well. And by the time I came along, they sort of had a working bullpen of bass players and keyboard players that were playing the shows with the group. And also, during that same period of time, Warren and Matt were working on and completing the Deep End Volume 1 and Volume 2, both studio records, with a very incredible cast of bass players and keyboard players. I was lucky enough to be a part of a few of those songs as well. And by the time I joined, which was after all of that, we had sort of discovered that the keyboards could, and it could keep the, I guess you could add, what I was trying to do was add keyboards without changing the original aesthetic of the band, which was, you know, just a hell-raising power trio. And, but I would also remind listeners and you too, Ira, that the last studio album that Alan Woody did with the band, Life Before Insanity, contained a bunch of keyboards on it by Johnny Neal. Really cool stuff. And external contributions from Hook Herrera and a number of guest vocalists. So the band was already expanding from the trio during the trio period. And so a lot of the blueprint of what the band could sound like with keyboards was right there on the Life Before Insanity album, while Alan was still with us. So it's not as black and white of a transition as you might think. And when I came along, I felt like the original trio aesthetic was what grabbed me, and the fire and the intensity of it and the bravado and the exploration of it. And so I set up a keyboard rig with the old records. I would play the old records through a PA, the trio stuff, Dose, the first record, Government Mule. Yeah. Try to find a way to bring keyboards into that. And I wasn't really paying attention so much to that middle period with all the other fellas involved, because to me, the trio was a thing. And so I kind of discovered that the rattier I sounded, the better off yeah. the trio was. And that keyboards in general might have a tendency to kind of gentleman up the sound, because number one, keyboards are ostensibly in tune, at least if they're working right. And so when you play them, and let's say you play a chord, you know, those notes just ring in tune. Right. Whereas when you play a guitar chord, those strings are alive and they fluctuate and breathe. It's not so precise,
right,
intonationally. So keyboards have a tendency, in spite of how aggressively you might be playing them, to kind of bring manners into the dinner table, so to speak. And I was careful, in my mind anyway, I was trying to be really careful not to be polite. And so that was more of a sonic tone type of decision. I wanted to use guitar amps and to stress the sound of the electric pianos. And I wanted my B3 to be more than just a pretty color.
Right.
And I suppose the attraction for me to rock and roll in general, as a young kid, was the elements of rebellion and protest and anger and the expressions that young people had back then, almost against the establishment, even though it wasn't necessarily political right from the beginning, it was still, at least in terms of the older generation, an act of rebellion. And that was what was incredibly attractive to me with regards to my own unsettled emotions as a kid and unnamed anger and unnamed angst, you know, that all teens have.
With all due respect, I don't find the playing that gentlemanly. I would say that it is, you are playing your instruments in a way, you know, that is very similar, I think, to the way Warren plays guitar and Matt plays drums, in that it is a ruckus back there behind all those keys and in from your hands. I mean, it's not just sprinkling of notes in between everything else. I mean, this is, it's full throttle when you're performing, and you don't, to me at least, to my ears at least, it doesn't seem gentlemanly, but I understand what you're saying in terms of it being in key and such.
Well, and I really appreciate what you just said very, very much, because to me that's sort of a mission accomplished moment.
Mm-hmm.
Because as a keyboard player in many, many different other situations, it's quite the reverse. And I also enjoy that role in those situations. Being pianistic, let's say, on a real acoustic piano, in a non-blues situation, like in a pop situation, is stuff I've done. And playing, sweetening, as you might call it, sweetening the situation, in a lot of different ensembles and jobs that I've had in the past, or as a session player, I've embraced the much more traditional aspect of being a keyboard player. But this was something that we actually discussed prior to my being a full-time member, in response to anybody's questions of what do you want to use for your rig, or what do you want to use, what do you want to play on this tune, or what do you want to play on that tune. I always referred to what we just talked about in terms of the mission as a keyboard player. And now I would say in the future you could point to other, you know, in the present now, you could point to other tunes where the keyboards are kind of sweet in a different way. And there is some acoustic piano here and there on Mule Records. And we do play a hook every now and then. get melodic and things like that. So none of this is a one-way street. It's all flux.
Right.
But as a general rule, if I stop playing, I want to hear the trio. in my head. And Jorgen, who's our bass player, is fully capable of doing that. So I'm in the luxurious position of feeling like the band sounds like Government Mule, whether I play or not. Now, other people might have a different feeling about that after all these years of me sort of, you know, mucking up the works. But but to me, that's what lies underneath the entire project. And it's what I was a fan of originally, and it's really important for me, to me, to respect that and to build off of that as I begin to add things. You know, someday maybe we'll start a tune in a keyboard fashion or something. I guess there might be one or two around there. Like, there's certainly Chuck's intro to Soul Shine.
Right. I was going to mention
original
that.
Original Mule recording of that. But as soon as the intro's over, there's lead guitar. So even before the vocal. So, you know, it's still... is Mule. It was just a keyboard intro, so to speak.
Right.
You know, and I don't know that we'll ever have a keyboard-based song, so to speak, nor would I want that. I think it's guitar rock, and it needs to be guitar rock. After all, you know, Warren Haynes is one of the premier, most special guitar artists alive. And, the sound that he puts out as a lead guitarist and also as a, you know, singer songwriter guitarist is where I'm going to get my keyboard stuff from.
So right.
It's kind of unconscious at this point. I'm being wordy about something that's really in your gut, in your pelvis, in your bile, more so than in your head.
I'm curious about, because you play Hammond, there's some Fender Rhodes, there are probably other keyboards that we as the audience don't know about. Is there one of those keyboards that's your favorite to play, or is it like talking about children? They're all your favorite.
Well, at the risk of hurting the other children's feelings, I would say the Wurlitzer electric piano,
right,
is what I could probably do the entire gig on and still be a happy camper.
Mm-hmm.
It's got an edge to it. It's rock and roll sounding to me. It can go from completely fuzzed out and mondo to bluesy and decorative. So I love the Wurlitzer electric piano as a rule on all the records that I grew up listening to. It was just a sound that got me. And when I... do little broken down gigs with Mule on smaller stages for different occasions. If I had to just play a Wurlitzer sound, I would be fine.
Before we get to the rest of our conversation on the Sound Podcast, I wanted to remind you about a pretty cool deal the folks at Nugs.net are offering. If you sign up today as a new subscriber, you'll get a 35% discount on an annual subscription. All you have to do is go to Nugs.net/the sound and sign up today. Now, back to our conversation. Trumpet is something that got you into Berkeley. You were amongst the best players growing up in the state for your age. Is that...
Who said that?
Well, just what I read, just what I hear. It's the word on the street.
Damn publicists.
Is that something that you miss playing? As I mean, you do get to play it on stage a little bit, and obviously because of, you know, medical conditions and stuff, you don't necessarily play it as much as you probably thought you would growing up. Is that something that you don't feel you play enough of? Is that something that you think should be in the mix more with Mule, or are you comfortable with kind of trumpet and guitar being two instruments that you sort of have in the back pocket that you can bring out when necessary?
You know, I think it's too, again, it's tune related, and each tune is different, and each tune can be different as well. Any other, you know, multiply different times that we play it. In the case of brass, because I did lose my ability to play the trumpet as a full-time player, which I used to be, it's one of those stories that has a cloud and also many silver linings. It certainly is something I miss as a musician, to be able to play all night long off the end of the trumpet, as high and as loud and as expressive as I would like to be. And when I do pick up the trumpet, it's sort of a version of what I used to be, but it's not what I used to be. And so there's some sadness there for me and some frustration. But I also get to feel a little bit of what that was and relive it in a role that's contributing to the ensemble. And so that's wonderful for me. It also steered me to becoming more of a full-time keyboard player.
Right.
And obviously for me, that's a very big silver lining, because I'm the keyboard player in Government Mule, which is amazing. I would also say that my discovery of the trombone is really kind of key to what's been going on more recently. And for me, when I pick up a brass instrument now with Mule, it's more often the trombone than the trumpet.
Right.
And I have a friend who's no longer with us. His name was his name is Roswell Rudd, R-U-D-D. And if you look him up, you'll know who he was with regards to the world of jazz trombone. He was a very important cat. And he was a neighbor of mine and one of my more recent mentors, and I think you don't have to be a child to have a mentor. And in my life, Roswell was clearly proof of that. Roswell was telling me, because I was expressing that frustration we were talking about, that when his lips are tired, he uses a tuba mouthpiece because it's bigger to help him relax his and get his strength back, relax his lips and get his strength back. And he said maybe a trombone mouthpiece would do that for you since it's bigger than a trumpet mouthpiece. Mm-hmm. So he actually gave me one of his trombone mouthpieces.
Wow.
And I took it home, and it was able to, the best way I can describe it to you, Ira, is it straddled the infirmary. So where I no longer could clamp with my muscles because of what I have going on, I was able to go around it because of the larger mouthpiece and create that clamp simply by pushing, which is technically incorrect.
Right.
And won't last for a really long time. You really want your facial muscles to do everything. But in the absence of that, I was able to figure out a way to actually play a lot more on the trombone than I ever could play on the trumpet. And so I'm enjoying that. I really am. Cool. It's been a hell kick for me. And oddly enough, it's a valve trombone, so the learning curve wasn't too crazy because the fingering positions are very similar. You're just in a different octave, and it's a different setup from the standpoint of playing it with your mouth. It's not the same as a trumpet at all. It's a different set of muscles that you're using, or a different way that you're using those muscles. But the valve trombone is also kind of a hybrid of two species, the slide trombone and the trumpet. Mm-hmm. And some people call it sterile. And I think that the sterile offspring of two species is also a mule.
That's right. Very good. Well done.
So that's not lost on me either.
all those lights. I want to sort of move towards the great release that is coming out now. Bring on the Music live at the Capitol in so many different incarnations, and you know it's kind of like a menu. People can choose which incarnation they want. But in watching some of the footage, the lights have become as important as probably the instruments being played on stage for the audience. And I'm curious, from your perspective behind all those keyboards, is that something that you feel immersed in as well as much as the audience? Do you feel what's going on with all of the other all the other sense mechanisms that are going on, like the lights? Do you feel that back there, and do you get a rush out of watching that stuff, or are you so into the music that you're playing that you can't really get distracted by anything else?
Well, it's yes and no. I mean, I'd have to be out of my body to see what the audience is seeing.
Right, but from your perspective, I mean.
And so very often, I'm delighted and quite amazed at what our lighting director guy, John, is doing when I see the pictures after the gig, you know, whether it's audience posts or stuff that we put out, or the record cover art that we're looking at on the various LPs and DVDs and CDs covers that are in this new package. We're a band that is listening very intently to each other, mm-hmm. and creating or trying to recreate something new every night. And so we're immersed, I would right. say. And on occasions, I'll look back at the backdrop and see what's going on. But for the most part, to answer your question, I'm knee deep in alligators.
That's right.
Trying to reinvent the wheel and focus on the music. I'm also aware of the fact that we're not augmenting our own performance with acrobatics and dancing and choreography. That's not what we do.
Right.
So the lights give the audience more to look at than just us standing there playing with our eyes closed or partially open or smiling and looking at everybody. Either way, we're not really running around doing, you know, karate kicks and somersaults. So the lights kind of...
But that is a thought, I think, you know. That is an idea. That would make it different every night.
Yeah, it was probably something we should have done 17 years ago.
Totally teasing.
At this point in time, I wouldn't recommend it. I'm very mindful of the presentation while it's happening.
Right.
But always delighted and surprised when I see the actual audience view of that stuff, which you just cannot get from the stage, no matter where you're sitting or standing. It's a full stage thing that he's doing,
yeah.
you know? So it's, you gotta be, I don't even know if, what that experience is like in the first four rows. You know, mm-hmm. it probably gets better and better the more you step back away from it. But I'm playing too many different instruments and right. trying to listen to all this incredible stuff my bandmates are playing, and you know, either rudely interrupt or politely compliment one or the other, or decide not to play,
right? Who makes the set list each night? Is that a groupthink project, or is it a Warren thing? I mean, because, well, for this package at least, you guys are really deep into the repertoire.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, what I find so interesting about the canon to this point of music is that, the breadth of music, so, you know, a tune like Thorazine Shuffle up against Soul Shine, up against, you know, some of the dub side stuff, up against some of the covers. I mean, just the breadth of music the breadth of songwriting, and then the various genres and mind-bending tunes that are part of the repertoire. I'm curious how, I know for a release like this and for something that's planned, obviously a great deal of time went into the set list to cover off the discography and the music. But on any given night, aside from these two special nights back in April of 2018, who sets the tone for the set list? Is that, I'm curious about how that comes to be.
Well, for sure, ultimately, Warren is the creative director of the band. Mm-hmm. And I would say that final call would always go to him. It's also a lead singer consideration as well.
Of course.
And so from his element, from his standpoint as both the lead singer and the creative director, there are major decisions that are being made there. However, and I don't know if you talked to Warren about this in the past, but we are very careful about not repeating, in the sense of whether it's the same place the year before or the last time we played there.
Right.
Or whether it's a neighboring city that we just played and that there might be folks that are going from one city to the next.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are certain things we would like to stay away from so that we can give a different show every night. That enables us to choose, let's say, if you want to call it a sidebar of tunes that are available to play. And the various guys in the band have welcome contributions. Warren welcomes everybody's thoughts on that, and very most often responds to those thoughts. And if somebody doesn't want to play something for whatever reason, whether it's there's an instrument issue that's not working, or whether it's a preparedness thing because we haven't played the tune in 3 years, or something like that, we'll defer to that person. Because we don't want anybody to play anything they don't want to play,
right?
For whatever reason that might be. So I would say the answer to your question is we all make contributions to the set list, but it's Warren's call finally. And that the thought about not repeating ourselves totally steers us to what tunes would be available to play that weren't either there the last time or in a neighboring city.
What's so special about playing the Capitol Theater?
Well, I mean, that was my second gig there. You know, those two nights, let's call those two nights one gig. That was my second gig there. The first time I played there was with John Scofield when he was on tour with us, supporting the Sco Mule release. And so I've only got two gigs under my belt there, and I can tell you for one thing, the physical facility is just incredibly gorgeous. The staff, the people that work there, the people that manage the place, Peter and everybody, mm-hmm. It's a great feeling when you're a player and you come there, a musician, and you come there. The welcome mat is as big as the universe. It just feels great. And when I'm on stage there and I'm looking out at the audience, the view that I'm, you know, there are certain venues where the audience kind of feels far away. And it may be the same capacity. It may be a 2,800 seater that feels like everybody's just so far away. And then there might be a 2,800 seater where you can take in the entire audience in one glance, because it's built vertically or the audience is closer to the stage or some combination of both. And in the Capitol Theater, the feeling I got was a great connection to the audience. So that's a very big positive thing. So between all those things, I think it's just really a great place to play.
You're playing Red Rocks this summer. It's already been announced. And that is probably in a different way, an exciting place to play, right? I mean, it is the beauty of facility and the not as intimate necessary. Well, is it intimate because of the environment in a very different way than the Capitol is intimate?
Oh yeah, I mean, first of all, it still feels like a sort of a home court gig for us, even though it's many states away from where I live.
Yeah.
And that's basically bred from familiarity because we've played there so many times. But I mean, I would say the view from stage is probably every bit as spectacular or even more than the view from the audience. And I've done both. There's a secret tunnel underneath the audience that goes up to the soundboard from the dressing room area.
Mm-hmm.
And when Matt's playing his drum solo, I'll go fly up there and have a look. Or when the opening, if there's an opener, is on stage, I'll go up there and have a look. And the view from the stage to the audience is almost like a show for me. Between the rocks and the way the sun and the moon often set and rise through those rocks. It's something that no other venue I've ever played offers. It's almost like a show for me while I'm playing.
Just a couple more questions, and these are fun little questions, I hope. You played Macon, Georgia earlier in the year, and you did a set, an entire set of Allman tunes, for obvious reasons. Is that daunting to play the parts of either Chuck LaValle or the great Greg Allman? Because you're the guy. You're the guy that needs to play those parts in Dreams and in Whipping Post. And is that daunting, or is it comfortable at this point, or is it, you know, having had some history with Greg, and obviously this band has a great deal of history with Greg, is it just par for the course? I mean, playing some of those songs.
Well, I mean, it's an experience of love because of the feelings I have towards the original creators of that music. Greg's role as a keyboard player was supportive. So from a technical standpoint, it's not daunting. I wouldn't use that word. I would say that it's a responsibility I take very seriously, because that music is part of the pantheon, and Warren and Woody were both members of that band, and I played with Greg, and I grew up on their stuff, and I certainly wouldn't want to turn it into a rearrangement that was unrecognizable, because given the personnel that we have on stage, that's simply not necessary. If I was in a band that had nothing to do with the Allman Brothers and I was playing an Allman Brothers song, I might be more challenged to completely reinvent it.
Uh-huh.
And try a whole bunch of new things. But because we're family and coming from that family, and maybe we'll do that someday just for fun, who knows. But when we're in that situation, like in Macon and stuff, and we're paying tribute to people we love who are no longer with us, or to a band we love who's no longer operational, and to music that we all grew up on and love, and to a keyboard player who taught me so much I can't even begin to express, I'm reverential towards it and
right.
Mindful, and I feel responsible. But daunting, I wouldn't say.
I know that when we listened to Jessica, a bunch of us, you know, we listened to it, and then we were trading texts back and forth, and the performance in Jessica's unreal, otherworldly, I'd say.
Is that from that Macon gig you're talking
about?
Yeah,
from that Macon gig. I just,
oh man,
amazing.
Did I evoke my inner Chuck?
Yeah. Your inner Chuck and then some. It was superb. We were, many of us were extremely impressed. Thank you for taking the time. I know that you have a party tonight, or a big showing tonight. and you're out on the road, and I can't thank you enough for this time, and more than that, for the last 17 years. You know, it's always a treat to see you bobbing your head with your toque on, and not just sprinkling in some anecdotes, but actually being a full cast member. We really appreciate the work that you do, Danny.
Well, that's incredibly nice of you to say, Ira, and I really appreciate you including me in your podcast. I'm quite honored, and I look forward to getting to speak with you in person the next time we see each other.
As you can hear, Danny Lewis has a lot to say, and we could have talked for hours. Unfortunately, he had to get organized to go back on tour. Even a release of a tremendous package like Bring On The Music live at the Capitol Theater won't stall the mule train from running. We're excited for you to hear and watch this tremendous package, filled with well-known mule tunes and some deeper cuts. For more information on the various versions of the package, and for upcoming tour dates plus much more, visit mule.net. Before we leave you, have a listen to another live track from the upcoming release. Here is The Man I Want to Be.
You've been listening to The Sound Podcast. Technical production by Adam Karsh and Andrea Ruse. Inspired by the music we love. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Instagram and Twitter. The Sound Podcast is part of the Osiris Network. For more, visit OsirisPod.com. Thanks for listening.
Osiris.